Hi, everybody. My name's Larry. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Larry.
And I want to thank you guys for the invite to come out and be here at your 8:30 meeting. Running a little early, are we? Right? Anyway, I'm glad to be here with you, and happy birthday to my friend Mark, and welcome to all the new people. Welcome. And I think Brian did a fine job of telling you what we have in store here, and I hope you stay and join us, you know. My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for 42 years and not amount to a damn thing. So I believe you found a home, yeah, you know. And I tell you, I am so glad that I finally got to the point where there wasn't any other place to go, you know. The decision had been made, you know. And so I'm glad to be with you. I was born in Detroit, Michigan, and came out here when I was about 6 years old. My mom and dad were great people, and they had some troubles, and they got a divorce, so they put me in a convent and then a convalescent home, and then I don't know whatever happened to me. They put me somewhere else, and my mom and dad they took off somewhere, and they decided to get married again, and so they gave it one more shot and got together and moved to California, and they said, oh, we forgot something. So they came back and got me, you know what I mean? And but they were great people, hard-working people, man. My life is not, the bad things are not their fault. My life is my fault. I'm the culprit, I'm the guy that did it, you know? And, you know, my mom was a little Scandinavian lady, and she loved diet pills, so she was always running around the house around midnight, you know, and sorting out nuts and bolts in the garage at night, you know, raking the neighbor's yard around 3 a.m, you know, and just a busy lady, you know, and you know what I mean? And no matter what time you got up, she was up doing shit, you know what I mean? Just, dusting, waxing, you know, and just a mover, you know. And then as some of you folks know, like in this section here, that if you need enough speed, that you have a lot of hobbies. Am I right? You know what I mean? Yeah, yeah. There's not a tooth in any head out there. You know what I mean? You betcha, pal. You know, and one of her favorite hobbies was to eat that speed and make these huge jigsaw puzzles, right? Not these little 2,000 piecers or, you know, 3,000, but the 1,000,000 piecers of the Mojave Desert, you know what I mean? She didn't want no confusion in color, you know what I mean? And, man, she used to get excited, put up that card table, you know, and set it up because she knew she was going to be planted there for about 4 or 5 days. And, boy, she'd get all ready for it and go down to the drugstore and get her can of peroxide, you know, and you know, put on her new muumuu and get her prescription filled, that's for damn sure, you know, and come back and smoke those Raleigh cigarettes. She smoked Raleigh cigarettes because they had a little coupon on the back that if you save enough coupons, you can buy stuff, you know, and she would buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in, man, you know, and oh my God, man, and, she'd be working on that thing, man, you know, and if she got a piece of puzzle that didn't fit, well, she had a big pair of toenail clippers, and she just snipped that, you know, wedge that thing in. There was no stopping Betty, man, you know what I mean? God bless her, you know, and I tell you, I never want to forget what it was like to be what? 17 years old, and you know, my mom was a beautiful lady. She looked like that old actress Kim Novak, And Betty was well liked, and everybody liked it. She had a host of friends, and everybody, you know, wanted to be with Betty because Betty was so fun. And when I was 17 years old, I never want to forget what I began to do to old Betty. Yeah. Betty was no longer that pretty little lady. I had whittled Betty down to 95 pounds. And she wasn't around a group of people. She was stuck in the front of a kitchen window smoking all day and night, wondering if that cop car would just stop. Is my son in there? Is that my baby boy? Wondering if that paper that just slid under the door, is that going to be the obituary of my son? You know? Staying there all night smoking. Seeing a dark figure down there. Is that my son coming home? Never want to forget that. Never want to forget that. I never want to forget what it was like to be 30 years old. Right? Walking the streets, hiding in her carport, sleeping in people's backyards and stuff like that. And I remember the jail bus dropping us off and at the South Bay Courthouse, and we were still supposed to go in and see the judge and all those guys, and they all started marching that way, and I took off and I went to Gardena. Now that was a Monday. I came back on a Thursday, and I didn't come back to the courthouse, and I didn't come back to my mom's house. No. Not this guy. I showed up at my mom's place of business. Yep. She was cleaning people's houses, and she worked at a dry cleaner's. And I came over there, and man, it was cold and rainy, and I had my bare feet, wine sores, needle marks, blood, what Wino Joe used to call the habiliments of despair. And I'm standing in that parking lot, and I'm about from here to that back wall, and I'm hiding behind a parked car so I can see the last customer come out. And that customer comes out, man, and I start walking through that rain with my bare, disgusting feet. My filth, my disgust, my selfishness. And I get up and I see the last customer come out of that laundry. And that brass bell hits that glass door. And my mom turns around and I walk in there. She says, "Oh my God, where have you been? Where have you been, Larry?" And I told her, "Don't worry, you've been Larry me." And I run by her, and she was peeling out some money. And I ran by her, and I took that $3, and I ran off to Wilmington where I'm going to die. Now, the thing that brings it home to me tonight, if you take this same man, new in Alcoholics Anonymous, with my so-called desperation, and I need to ask you something. How come when my life depends on it, I can't come to you folks? How come when my life depends on it, I can't walk that same distance to that dry cleaner's and walk that same distance and ask the secretary for a job in a meeting that's going to save my life? Why is that? And I'd guarantee you this. If I can find the thing that keeps me from serving you, I will have found the key to life. There's a miracle here. There is a miracle here. And if I can find that thing that keeps me from serving you, I'll find the key. You see, I'm used to sitting in rooms. waiting for you to do something for me. I've had my hand out my entire life. That's something for nothing guy. That's me. Now, why would it be any different here? You see? And that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. The idea of getting anything is wiped out. And if you haven't noticed, if you're new, there's nothing to get in AA. Look around you, for God's sakes. There's nothing to get here, man. You know, the only thing you're going to get here, if you're new, is be prepared to be divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your damn life, man. It's the longest thing I've ever done against my will my entire life, man. Which is why it works so well. You know? That's the neat thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, my dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy, singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Dylan drunk. He was a go-getter, man. He was a refinery worker, so he was always coming home at different hours, you know, and he never knew when he was coming home. And one night he snuck in through my bedroom window, you know, and that old refinery boot comes down on my chest, you know, and I grabbed that boot and I said, "Hey, Pop," I said, "you know, why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys? You know, hell, she's up anyway, you know what I mean? I can, you know, she's probably making with her little teeth, you know." So, you know, but, you know, and man, he loved to sing and, you know, get drunk and sing those Bobby Darin songs and Frank Sinatra songs. And I mean, he made drinking look good. His drinking didn't scare me, you know. And, but growing up, I started hearing things and seeing things in the house that I didn't understand. And it became hard to trust these people, to love these people that I didn't trust. And I didn't understand what was going on, and I had nobody to talk to. But the thing that got me is by the time I got to you, everything that I thought was foul and disgusting, and I blame myself for. Why didn't I stop it? Why didn't I go after him? Why didn't I, you know, how come I, and I felt guilty. And I felt so guilty that I couldn't trust these folks that I loved, that I couldn't stand being with them. And I started running away from home. I felt more a part of a street light in downtown LA than I did my own dinner table. And I don't know why that was. But I didn't bother trying to figure it out. I just went with it. And so at about, you know, 11 years old, man, there was about four of us, and we were in a garage, and my little buddy Louis Sanchez got some Four Rose whiskey, you know. And so we got together with a couple guys, and we started drinking that Four Rose whiskey. And, man, that's just like Brian was saying, man, I took a couple gulps and sprayed the walls, you know what I mean? But I hung in there. Any good alky, right? Hung in there and eventually started guzzling that stuff with him, and, you know, and man, I just, I never laughed so hard my entire life that day, man, you know. I never puked so much as I did that night, you know, and it was great. That evening, I kissed my first Latin woman. It was my aunt. My 46-year-old Auntie Della. I went right after her, you know. And I counted it, you know. And man, and I remember that walk home. I remember that walk home. Me and Louie laughing and falling in bushes and stuff like that. And I finally got to my house and, you know, first thing I did is look for Dad's car, and it wasn't there, so I got to go in the house, you know, without getting hammered by anybody, and made it to my room and fell back on that bed, and it took off, you know. And I woke up the next morning, and I thought, oh, man, he is going to light me on fire, you know. He damn near chopped my hands off for smoking. God only knows what's going to go on now, you know. And, no, he wasn't there. So I thought, man, I'm gonna go sneak into his... He had a little room, and he had his own bar. Pop made his own bar. And it wasn't, you know, one of those ones where you can line up 20 people, you know what I mean? It was an alky bar. Fit one guy, you know what I mean? There's Pickles Pig Feet, and then there's Frank Sinatra albums, you know what I mean? That was it, you know what I mean? And so I thought, man, it'd be great to get in there, and I went to get in there, and he had a lock on that thing about the size of a big book, you know? So there was no getting in there, you know? And, but that started my cheerio. Now, I had just gotten drunk the night before. So, I didn't hit Skid Row and go to the Alano Club and, you know, anything like that, you know. I started going over that night before. Now, I've always been a nobody, I know that. Nobody's ever had to convince me. I've been a nobody, I knew it. I was sold on it. And what I remember about that evening is that this little rotten nobody was somebody for 6 hours. And I didn't have to study for it. I didn't have to go to school for it. I didn't have to do anything for it but drink that Four Rose whiskey. And I didn't head out to Skid Row that next day or anything like that, but I did become preoccupied with doing it again. And, you know, as the years goes on, you find ways of doing it and stuff. And by the time I got into high school, kids were going to their locker rooms to get their books and pencils, and I'm going to my locker room to get a little shot of some Thunderbird and maybe take some barbiturates or something like that to ease the tension of being dumb, you know. And and we were off and running. I started dating this little Mexican girl, and she had some brothers, and they like cars, and I love cars to this day, you know. I don't have these big Dodge trucks like you guys have out here where you can drive over each other's houses every weekend. You know what I mean? But I did have a 62 Chevy Impala dropped right down to the ground. Had my hair slicked and sprayed and pulled back, man, and, and I had a date this little girl named Loopy, and, she used to curl her hair with soup cans and the noodles were stuck in there, you know what I mean? And we used to drive around in that car and listen to the Four Tops and the Temptations and the OJs and Marvin Gaye. God, I loved it, man. Wasn't too long ago, I was in my truck and the OJs came on and I just started sinking in my damn truck, you know what I mean? Oh, yeah, man. And one more time, I became somebody. This little nobody became somebody, you know. And in my own mind, which is the only thing that counts, I became Lawrence of Torrance, you know what I mean? Nobody else knew it, but I knew it. And that was the paycheck, you know what I mean? Oh, yeah, we'd bounce around all night. And, man, and I remember one day we were drinking some tequila early in the morning, and she said, around noon, she said, pull over to the Jack in the Box. Let's talk to the puppet. We were a lonely couple, you know. And I pulled into the Jack in the Box, and I got 10 of them talking to me, you know what I mean? Can I have your order, please, you know? I don't know which one's the real one, but I pulled up in there, and I ran over the real one. Man, his head's bouncing like that, you know? So they arrested me. I couldn't drive till I was 33, a couple of years in A&A, and we were off and running, man. Me and Pooch and Loopy, we were going to ride off into the sunset, you know. And then I thought, you know what, man, it's getting a little dull out here. I think I'm going to grab my dope dealer and head off to Detroit and find my roots, you know. So I grabbed my little buddy and head off to Detroit to find our roots, you know, and wound up in Phoenix, you know. Central and Roosevelt, the Apache Hotel. Everybody's got a bathroom, it's down the hall, you know, and everybody's got a TV, it's in the lobby, you know. you got to come up with your $12-$13 a day, you know. And I'm afraid to leave my room, and I'm afraid to go out at night, you know, and I don't know what I'm going to do with myself. So I find a nice little watering hole not too far there called the Wagon Wheel Bar. And it's a beautiful bar. You guys would love it. There's no windows, just a dirty red curtain blowing through the doorway, you know. And I go in there, and I meet a guy named Ernie. Every bar has an Ernie. Ernie is the answer man. I don't care what your problem is, Ernie's got the answer, and it's usually in his trunk, you know. And so I go there and talk to Ernie, and he says, "Well, son, I tell you what, why don't you come here in the morning?" He says, "I think I got an answer for you." So I showed up there in the morning, and he introduced me to a plumber. Now, I've never plumbed a thing in my life, let alone work at all, you know. And the closest thing to plumbing I've ever had was throwing up in the toilet. That was it, you know. That's it, you know. And he introduces me to this plumber. And this plumber takes me out to Tempe, Arizona. And he sticks me underneath the house. He says, "Look at," he says, and I tell you, we'd been robbing some houses and stuff like that. And if there's anything I love, it's a strange home. I mean, I don't care if it's the attic, you know, underneath it, as long as it has a medicine chest that I can inspect, you know. And, oh, yeah, I love being in your home, you know. And so he sticks me out there, and he puts me underneath this house. And I got a transistor radio, and I got a pint of bourbon. And he tells me, he says, "All I want you to do, son, is hang copper under here. That's all I want you to do. And I'll come back in about 8 or 9 hours and see how you're doing." So he took off and he left me underneath this house. Well, man, I am just on fire because I love being in strange homes, man. And you never know what you're going to find underneath those houses, you know what I mean? So I start crawling around more than 5 or 10 minutes, man, and I discover this cat over there in the corner. "Oh my God, look at it, it's a cat. This is fabulous. I could see my life coming together, man, you know. I've got some whiskey, I've got a transistor, I got a pet, you know. And normal living's coming at me, you know. And this is great, man, you know." And so I got my little pet, you know, and I start hanging that copper like he wants me to, and then I find a hole in the floor, and so I bust open through the floor, and I get to the lady's house, and I start going through her medicine chest and taking a couple things off her jewelry and stuff like that. And eventually I pass out, and the old boss rolls in, and he sees me under there, and he just, "All right," he starts dragging me out, you know what I mean? And then this cat comes running out with about 14 necklaces, you know what I mean? And he puts me in jail for about 7 months down in Arizona, and I get out of there, and I go back to the bar, you know. And Ernie says, okay, listen, this is what we're going to do. He says, "Not too far from here is a horse track. We're going to get you down to 95 pounds. You're going to be a jockey." And I said, "This is great, man. I can start working out and stuff like that." He said, I don't know about that. He said, "All I want you to do is I'm going to give you some stuff that'll help you." And he gives me a little white bag, you know what I mean? And he says, "All I want you to do is take this stuff, and in a couple of months I'll come and get you." So he leaves me in that room with this powder. Now, I'm used to just drinking whiskey and doing heroin, minding my own business, you know what I mean? He doesn't come back in 2 months. He comes back in 2 weeks, right? And knocks on the door, and he opens up the door, and I'm standing. He says, "Oh my God," he says, "you couldn't have possibly taken." "Well, I did, Ernie. You can put a saddle on my ass and ride me around here, you know what I mean?" I'd never taken this stuff before, man. I was locked in that room chasing flies around my room and looking out the window every 10 seconds. What's that? You know? And then the other half of the day, I'm underneath the bed, scared to death. Because I'm seeing these awful black and white flashes that are just scaring us. And it's the sun coming up and down, man. Oh, my God, there it is again. You know, make it stop, you know. He says, oh, my God, you know. So he canned me out of that job. So I hooked up with another plumber. And I worked for this guy for about, I don't know, about 2.5 hours. You know, I became an easy reader of bad bosses, you know, and worked for 2.5 hours. And, you know, I found out that he was younger than me. I ain't worked with no kid. I've got my pride, right? So I did what any honorable man would do. I faked a knee injury. And so faked the knee injury. They took me to a fake doctor, and he gave me a fake prescription for Percodan. And as he left the room, he left a cardboard box full of blank prescription pads he wanted me to have, right? Well, this was kind, right? I took that old box, man, and I'm running down North Central, you know. I'm on fire, and I went into the bar, and I said, look at this, Ernie, look at this. He said, oh, my God, this is great. This is great. You know, and he got a PDR book, you know, and man, we started, you know, drinking that whiskey and doing heroin and writing those prescriptions. We started writing prescriptions for everything, man. Seconal, Nebitol, Tuinol, you name it all. We wrote it all, you know, and damn near took it all, too, you know. And after about 9 months, they caught up with me. And when you're loaded on, you know, some good old whiskey or tequila and some barbiturates, there's no freeway chase down this coast highway, you know what I mean? I was going 9 miles an hour, and the cop was on foot. He was just coming by me, hey, roll that window down, you know? And I said, my God, can this man run, you know what I mean? So he threw me out of that car, threw me in jail, and got out of there in 1973, and they shipped me back to California in 1974. I went to the Los Angeles Probation Department, and they put me on antabuse. They did no talk of AA, no talk of counseling, nothing like that. They just stuck me on this antabuse. And I got about 90 days. I was in a boarding house in downtown Torrance. You guys know what that's like. It's just a hallway with 5 little rooms. Everybody's got a bed, a chair, and a little window. And at this time in my life, people are saying things to me. Too many of them saying the same thing. And most of them are, what are you going to do with your life? Do you have any goals? Do you have anything you're looking forward to doing? And the only goal that I could think of that I had was, oh, maybe once or twice a week, I would look out my little window in a boarding house. And I would see another boarding house across the street, the Roy Tan. And it said, boarding rooms for rent with hot plates. And I said, man, that's it. One of these days, I'm going for that, man. One of these days, man. And I had my goal, right? Well, eventually I got 90 days on that antabuse, nothing, just that antabuse, man, and bitter and hostile. And I get a job interview from my probation department to go to a refinery in El Segundo to be a part-time janitor at midnight. So I had to go for an interview to this little goofy town named El Segundo. And so it's like rolling into Mayberry, you know, and back then, and so I found myself, and you know, when you're taking buses, there's none of this, I'll be right there. Yeah, you know, you're 3 hours early or 4 hours late, you know what I mean? And so I was about 3 or 4 hours early, and I started wandering the town like I do, and I went into this baseball park, and I get into this Little League dugout, and man, I start crying like a baby. And then I start laughing like a clown. And this goes on for about a half hour or so. And then this paranoia and hallucinations that I used to get when I would DT or be coming off something, It's nailing me, and I ain't on nothing but the anabuse. And it's locking, and these hallucinations are locking. And I start walking that field, that little baseball field, because I don't know what's going on. And somebody sees me wandering around there, and they call the paramedics, and they come and get me. And they take me to the Harvard General Hospital in Carson, California. And I'm on a bed with an arm and a leg strapped down to the gurney, and a well-meaning doctor comes over to the side of the bed. And he says, "Son," he says, "we don't have a good idea what's going on with you, but we need to send you to some place where they can observe you and find some answers for you." And so they rolled me up and put me in a little van and sent me to a place that had some answers for me. And they told me I'd be there for 30 or 60 days. And a year later, they let me out. Camarillo State, you know, came out of there, and they gave me a certain medication and stuff like that. And after about 3 months out on 4 months out on the street, I ran out of the medication, and I did what I always would do now. Is at this time in my life, there is nothing that you don't do for a shot of alcohol. There is no invisible line. And I spent my life walking from Long Beach to downtown LA every day, to the jungle, and that was all. In 1975, they found me at a Chevron station across from Alvaro Street in downtown LA, passed out on a pile of tires. And they came and they arrested me in public intoxication, violation of probation, and out-of-state forgeries. And so they rolled me up and took me over to they took me over to the L.A. County jail, and I was there for a bit, and they sent me to the South Bay Courthouse, and where they were going to sentence me to 3 years in the penitentiary. And they gather all of us guys, and we're in a holding tank about the size of this room. And one by one, the judge is calling all these guys out, and they're not coming back. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm the only one left. I'm on a concrete floor with a Vons bag and no hope, wondering whether. Where are they going to send me now? They're always sending us somewhere, right? And 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the only one there, and all of a sudden I hear that most beautiful sound that a lot of us love, and it's the sound of some jailer keys coming down the hall. And I hear these keys, you know, and I stand up, and they roll open this door. And there's this Scottish man with a patch standing there. "Hi, lad." He says, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "Ah, that's great. That's great." He says, "Come with me, son. We're going to AA." And I thought, AA? What's AA? And, you know, who's this Scottish pirate all of a sudden, you know? Where's your parrot at, you know? "Hey, lad," you know? And so, I didn't know what AA was. And so, you know, like I usually do, I just, you know, got in the car and, you know, thought we were going to have a long ride and some lunch or something, right? And he takes me for a 15-minute car ride to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he rolls up to this dingy, stinking, rotten, filthy Torrance La Mita Alano Club. And I said, what the hell is an Alano anyway? You know what I mean? Is it like an elk or a moose? You know? Watch for crossing Alanos, you know? And rolled up to this club, and he starts introducing me to all these goofy people, Indian Genie, Captain Bob, Tennessee Bill, Singin' Sam, Serenity Sam, Bicycle Ray, you know? Jesus, all the, you know, Whistling Pete, and you know, and all these people, you know, and my God, I, you know, everybody had a little nickname or a tattoo, and this little lady named Moose comes running after me. She was about 150. She, hi, honey, she says, my name is Moose, and I'm expecting a miracle. I said, I bet you are. I said, you know, I ain't it, you know what I mean? But I got Brian's number, you know what I mean? So I said, oh my God. And then this transvestite starts circling me like a helicopter in Long Beach, you know, and he comes up to me and he says, hi. He says, I can't wait to take you to our candlelight meeting. I said, I don't think so, pal, you know, not till I get my year, you know. You know how they are around here, don't you? You know what I mean? And we always talk about our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And we always come up with these beautiful phrases and paragraphs that really mean something to us. I never thought about a word or a page of those things. I came in and out of the rooms of AA from 75 to 82, and I never thought about a beautiful page in AA. But what I did remember were the faces of the people. I could remember the people. And I still remember the people. Because you knew you had something special. You knew. And the way you treated me and these meetings, that's what we care for. We care about these meetings if you're new. We care about this book and the way of life in it. Somewhere in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll see that phrase. Life will take on a new meaning. Damn well better. It damn well better, pal. And on May 2nd, 1982, I was in the downtown Wilmington at a mission. And every time I called you folks, you would come and get me. Every time I called AA, you came and got me. And you never hovered over me and, are you ready yet? You know. Get in the car, son, you're coming with us. And I got kicked out of the mission only because that's their policy. They kick you out at 5, and then they, if you want, you can come back at 6 and sing for your beans and stuff. And they kicked me out there, and one more time I'm in an alley, and I got a rug or something over me, you know. And the thought came to me this. I'm 30 years old, and I'm sitting in an alley with a carpet wrapped around me. I don't know what to do with my life. I don't know what to do with my life. I'm going to call that guy from AA and have him come pick me up. And I usually would call, and I'd get this guy named Don, Montana Cowboy Don. And he would always come and get me. Sure enough, I went out up on the streets. I panhandled some bucks. And I called Don. I said, Don, this is Larry. I'm ready to come back to AA. Will you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, no. He says, "No, I don't think so, hotshot. You know where we are. You know what we got." He says, "Why don't you get your rusty rear down here yourself? I'm tired of chasing after you." And he hung up. I said, "My God, what kind of AA love is this?" Well, the kind you need. And man, I was furious because nobody hangs up on me. You know, haven't talked to anybody in 15 years, but nobody hangs up on me, right? And man, you know what? I got to go down there and tell that guy. I was mad at him, man. You don't do that, yell at me like that. And so I thought, well, okay, I'm going to walk that 10 miles from Wilmington to Torrance, and I'm going to talk to that guy, that rotten cowboy, you know. So I started making it down to Torrance, you know, and it took me about 2 weeks, you know, about 10 miles, you know what I mean, and rolled up to that club, and they said, "What do you want? We got a meeting going on here, and you're banned from the meeting because you disrupt them." And I said, "Well, if it interests you, I'm looking for Don." They said, "Well, it looks like he's pulling up right now." And Don pulls up in that little El Camino, and he stood in the doorway, and he says, "I hear you want to talk to me." I says, "You bet, man." So I grabbed all my gear and walked up to that guy, and I said, "I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor?" He lit up like a chandelier for about 5 seconds. Then he lit into me for 20 minutes. "You make the effort, I'll make the effort." And I loved him. I started doing things regardless of how I felt. I started doing things because I didn't want to leave you. I didn't want to go out there and be alone again. So I started doing the uncomfortable to get comfortable. You know? I started serving this thing that I wanted so much from. Things began to change for me. Started doing things in my home group. Started making amends. And I have no regrets. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I hope life takes on a new meaning. We want you here. We want you here. We want to see your life. We want to see you start doing something for somebody else. Isn't that amazing when you see that person change? Damn it, he's got it. He's got it, man. Start making amends to people. Start making amends to that little mother of yours. Taking care of her when she's in her little rest home, you know. She was in this little rest home and 5 floors high, and I went over there one day and I said, "You know, Mom," I said, "all these other ladies have real flowers on their porch." I says, "But you got these plastic ones." I says, "I'm going to get you some real flowers. We're going to have roses and wooden boxes and you're going to love it." She says, No, I don't want it, honey. I don't want it." I said, "You don't understand." I said, "I'm going to take care of it. I'll take care of it. I'll water it. You won't have to do nothing, but you will have real flowers like all these other ladies." He says, "No, honey, I don't think I really want that." I said, "Okay, I don't believe you understand. These are real flowers, and they're yours. They're all yours, Mom, and I'll take care of them, and you'll have real..." She says, honey, stop. She says, "I love my plastic flowers. Don't throw them away." She says, "I love to sit here in the morning and watch the hummingbirds suffer." So See you guys later.